Good evening, gentlemen. It's nice to be back once again to be discussing some Torah thoughts. I just wanted to share something with you, something that I myself said over in Yeshiva about a week ago. Something that's relevant to the Parsha and also, I think, our entire service of Hashem that we do every single day. When Moshe went to Paro to tell Paro that you have to free the Jews, Paro said, not only am I not going to free them, I'm going to make them gather their own straw, thus making things far, far worse for the Jews. However, when Hashem asked Moshe, or told Moshe rather, that you are going to be my spokesman, my shliach, to go to Paro and tell him to free the Jews, Hashem said to Moshe, I am aware that Paro is not going to free you right away. And not only that, Hashem actually told Moshe, the Medrash relates, that Hashem knew, which of course Hashem did, Hashem told Moshe that Paro is not going to free you, and not only that, he's going to make things worse and make you collect your own straw. And the reason the Medrash tells us that Hashem did this is in order that Moshe should not complain. And should not say, Hashem, why are you making things worse for the Jews? And despite this, the Medrash goes on to say that Moshe did in fact complain, saying at the end of Parsha Shemos, Ulama Harios al Avdecha, why have you made things worse for your servants? It's almost as if Hashem was saying to Moshe, Moshe, we have to take one step back in order to take two steps forward. That's part of the plan. Part of the plan is that things have to get worse before they can get better. And he did this in order to sort of forestall Moshe's complaints, that Moshe would say, Hashem, why are you making things worse for the Jews? Because now Moshe could see, well, the reason is because we're trying to make, not we, but we, the Moshe and Hashem team, kiviyachol, as if such a thing could exist, but are trying to make things better for the Jews, and in order to do that, things have to get a little bit worse. Something that I thought was very interesting is the fact that the strategy Hashem employs in order to forestall Moshe's complaints is a strategy of preparation. It's a strategy of Hashem saying to Moshe, Moshe, before you go in there, I want you to be aware of what's going to be. And it's not just a question of preparing Moshe in order that Moshe should not be shocked. The reason the Medrash tells us that Hashem spoke to Moshe in this way and told Moshe what was going to be is in order that Moshe should not complain. And I think we can safely say that the reason that Hashem did not allow Moshe to complain had nothing to do with Hashem's own benefit from that. Because why would it matter to Hashem one way or the other if Moshe complained? The only reason it would matter to Hashem is for Moshe's own spirituality, for Moshe's own ruchnias. That it was imperative for Moshe's own success that Moshe not complain. That was sort of the right thing for him in that situation. And in fact, we see later on, at the end of the Parsha, when Moshe does in fact complain to Hashem, that Moshe is taken to task for this. Chazal do say that Hashem was unhappy with Moshe's conduct in this instance. And although it was driven for a tremendous, tremendous empathy for Moshe's fellow Jews, even though he himself was not a slave, but to see all of his fellows enduring even worse suffering than they already had, bothered him so much that he couldn't help but cry out to Hashem nevertheless. This was something that Hashem viewed as wrong. It was, on some level, a lack of assurity, a lack of confidence that Hashem's will was being carried out and that Hashem had a plan to eventually take Klal Yisrael out. And what's strange is that Moshe knew that this was part of the plan. It was almost as if Hashem said to Moshe, Moshe, here's the plan. We're going to go to Paro, things are going to get worse in order that they can then get better, and then we're going to take Klal Yisrael out. That's the plan, let's go do it. Moshe goes in there, things get worse. And Moshe turns to Hashem and says, Hashem, why'd you make things worse? Hello, Moshe, didn't you know that that was part of the plan? How did you miss that? Did you forget since the last time we spoke? Did you not get the memo? In other words, Hashem sort of told Moshe the future, gave him a nevuah, something which is in itself somewhat unusual for Hashem to simply let Moshe in on his divine plan. There's no reason for that. And the only reason really was in order that Moshe should pass an assignment, and nevertheless he still failed. How could such a thing be? I think the answer is that no matter how prepared we are for a given situation, And of course, it's always worthwhile to be prepared. Hashem tried preparing Moshe. Hashem used that strategy. Clearly, it's a good strategy to employ. Nevertheless, it's very, very difficult until we've actually been in a particular situation to really know how we're going to respond and to be able to prepare adequately. It's something that we can always use more preparation and more sort of defenses, so to speak, against doing the wrong thing. It's something that we can always strengthen in ourselves as a way of enabling us in the long term to be good Avdei Hashem. And I think what else is significant from this Chazal is the fact that the strategy that Hashem did in fact employ, a strategy which we see has the greatest stamp of approval, is the strategy of preparation. That's the strategy Hashem used, because Nisyonos are not fought and won in the heat of the Nisayon. It's not during that minute of challenge when you're faced with the choice of the right and the wrong thing that the battle is won, but it's before, based on the preparation that you did, that's going to enable you to make the right choice. Or prevent you from making the right choice by your lack of preparation or the wrong preparation. When we psych ourselves up, so to speak, to do the right thing, and when we're really ready to do it, we will. And that's how we become better doers of Hashem's will, by being prepared. By getting ourselves ready and by telling ourselves, today I want to do Hashem's will, and then going out and doing it. Because beforehand we're ready. And that's the strategy that we have to employ whenever we're faced with a challenge. Before the challenge comes in front of us, we have to tell ourselves, well, what would we do if this happens? The answer is, the right thing to do is X, Y, and Z, and that's what I'm going to try and do. By learning Musar and connecting to the Torah, by doing these things, we can really, really empower ourselves to do the right thing every day, all the time. So just something that was a very powerful message to me, and I wanted to pass it along. So, without further ado, let us begin Dav Zayin Amud Aleph at the bottom. We're at the two dots, three lines into the wider lines. This is going to take us on to Zayin Amud Beis. And we're going to discuss a little bit of Shavar Brachos. Let's see what the Gemara has to say. Amar Rabbi Chelbo, Amar Rav Huna, Amar Rav Ab, Bar Zavta, Amar Rav. Rabbi Chelbo said the name of Rav Huna in the name of Rav Abba, Bar Zavda in the name of Rav. A nice long chain of Mesorah there, saying over the following statement: Achas Besula v'achas Almana t'una Bracha. Whether a Besula or an Almana requires Bracha. In other words, when a Besula gets married or when an Almana gets married, either way, Bracha is required at that ceremony. So the Gemara asks the following question: Umi Yomar Rav Huna Hachi? Did Rav Huna in fact say this? We know we listed Rav Huna in that litany, in that chain of Mesorah, saying over that statement. That means Rav Huna himself ascribed to the statement. Did Rav Huna in fact say this? V'ha'amar Rav Huna Almana Eina Tuna Bracha. Rav Huna said just the opposite. Almana does not require a bracha. There are no brachos said when an Almana gets married. So that seems to be in direct contradiction to what we just said, that Besula and Almana get bracha, a widow and a virgin. So the Gemara answers, "Lo kasha." That's not a question. That's not a contradiction. Kan bebakar shena salmana. Kan be'almon shena salmana. The instance where there is bracha is where it is a young man who's never been married before who marries an almana. And in that instance, the fact that she's marrying somebody who's never been married before, that extra simcha is what creates the necessity of bracha, of shavar brachos in that instance. However, if it is a widower who marries a widow, in that instance, we do not require a bracha. Well, the Gemara challenges that statement as well. If you're going to tell me that when Rav Huna said an almana does not require a bracha, that's a case where an almana marries an almon, a widower marries a widow. The almon shenasa almana lo, does a widower who marries a widow not require a bracha? The ha'amar hav nachman amar li huna bar nasan. And again, this is a quote of Rav Huna. We're all discussing statements of Rav Huna. Otherwise, we could potentially say that there's an achlokas at play. However, these are all Rav Huna. Rav Huna has to be able to be reconciled with himself, at the least. Rav Nachman said that Huna Bar Nosson said to me, Tana, minayin lebirkas chasana basara. From where do we know this is a Mishnah that Huna Bar Nosson or Huna said over? From where do we know that the birkas chasana and shavar brachos has to be said with 12, excuse me, with 10? Shenemar v'yikach chasara anashim mizignei hayir. This is a pasuk in Rus. when Boaz, at the end of the Megillah, married Ruth, he took 10 men from the elders of the city, Vayomer, and he said to them, Shvu po, Vayeshvu, sit here, and they sat. And he was bringing them in order to make Shavar Brachos. The Gemara asks, Uvoaz, and Boaz, Amon Shinas Almanahava. Boaz was a widower, because he himself had been married in the past. And he was marrying Ruth, who herself was a widow, because she had been married to Machlon. So, in that instance, we see an Almon Shinas Almanah is having bracha. So how can you tell me, we just said, that an Almon Shinas Almanah does not have a bracha, does not require bracha, does not require Shavar Brachos? So the Gemara answers, "My ena tu in a bracha." What does it mean when we said that almon shenas almana, a widower and a widow, do not require shavar brachos? Damar Avuna, which Ravuna said, "Ena tu in a bracha kol zayin." It means they don't require 7 days of shavar brachos. Aliyom echad tu in a bracha, but there was one day of shavar brachos. That day that they got married, that day there is shavar brachos at the ceremony. But of course, we're talking about the shavar brachos of the entire week. In other words, this earlier statement of Rav Huna Amar Rav, or I should say Rabbi Chabo Amar Rav Huna Amar Rav, Zavda Amar Rav, that whole litany of whether Besula, whether Almana both require Shavar Brachos, that was talking about Shavar Brachos for 7 days. However, when Rav Huna said an Almana does not require Bracha, that's for an Alman Shinas Almana who only requires Bracha for 1 day. So we still need the answer that we said previously, the distinction between a bachar, a single person, a single man, and an alman, a widower. And additionally, we need the distinction between shavar brachos for an entire week and shavar brachos just for the 1 day. So the Gemara now asks another question. Elohad d'tanya, but that which we learned in the Braisa, shaktu chacham al takanos benos Yisrael, shihe sameach ima gimel yamin, that Chachamim were concerned about Benos Yisrael, that the Chosim, the husband, should be rejoiced with his new wife for 3 days. But my, what's that case? What is the significance of 3 days come from? Iba Bachar, if we're talking about a Bachar, Ha'amar Shiva. You said that a Bachar is 7 days of Shavar Brachos. So why are you telling me 3 days? It's really seven. Because again, we know that's talking about an Almana in that instance. That's why an almana gets married on Thursday evening, in order that Friday, Shabbos, and Sunday, Thursday, Friday, and Shabbos, there should be those 3 days of Simcha. Iva Amun, if it's talking about a widower, Ha'amrit Yom Echad, we already said that an Amun who marries an almana only requires 1 day. So again, why is it 3 days? It's either one or seven, it shouldn't be three. So just to go through, before we see the Gemara's answer, exactly the sort of what we call the assembly line, the cheshbon of the Gemara in this last few several steps. We started with a statement that said that Besula and Almana require Shavar Brachos. And at that point we didn't know whether it was 1 day, 7 days. We didn't see any such distinctions. It's all or nothing. Then we saw a statement that an Almana does not require a Bracha. Apparent contradiction. Does an Almana require a Bracha or not? So therefore we answered that an almana does require bracha. However, that's only in an instance where she marries a bachar. So both a besula and both an almana require shavar brachos when they're marrying a bachar. But if you're marrying an almon, it does not require bracha. So at that point, it's still all or nothing. There's no distinction between 1 day and 7 days. However, there is a distinction between a bachar who marries an almana and an almon who marries an almana. Then the Gemara asks the following question. That, what do you mean an Almon and an Almana don't have any Shavar Brachos? We see that they do. So the answer is they don't have 7 days, but they do have 1 day. So now, going back up the line towards the beginning of what we started with, that which Rav Huna said a statement that an Almana does not get a Bracha, that means an almana who marries an almon, a widow who marries a widower, does not require bracha for 7 days. However, a widow who marries a bachar does require bracha for 7 days. The reason we have to say this is because when a widow marrying a widower requires a bracha only for one day, and that's what it means when it says Eina Tuna Bracha, that she doesn't require a bracha of 7 days, but she does require a bracha of one day. So then when we tell me that an almana who marries a bachar does require a bracha, it'd be awfully silly to tell me that an almana who marries a bachar does require a bracha for one day, but not for seven. Additionally, the fact that an almana in that instance of marrying a bachar is grouped together with besula, who we know requires a bracha for all 7 days, we know has several brachas for 7 days, it's additionally indicative of the fact that an almana who marries a bachar is going to have shavu brachos for all 7 days. However, now we come to a further standstill, because we know that there's a takana made for an almana that she should have the chasen celebrating with her for 3 days. Which chasen is it? Is it the chasen of the original statement, who's a bachar, who's they're going to make shavu brachos for 7 days? Or is it the widower, an almon, in which case they're going to have shavu brachos for 1 day? Where does the 3 days come from? So the Gemara answers, Yibayis Eima Ba'amon Yom Echad Lebracha B'Shlosh L'Simcha. One answer we could give is that it's talking about a widower, and there's only 1 day of Shavu Brachos, but there's 3 days of rejoicing. And similarly, they say, another answer we could say, Yibayis Eima B'Bachar Shiva. Excuse me, B'Bachar. It's talking about the Takana is for a case of an Almana, a widow who marries a Bachar, but it's 7 days of Shavu Brachos, but only 3 days of Simcha, because there's not the same elevated level of Simcha when the Bachar is marrying an Almana, a widow. Rashi says an interesting comment at this point in the Gemara. Let's take a look at the Rashis on the Gemara we've read so far. Rashi, Ti'una Bracha, Birchas Chasan, the Bracha of Chasanan, which again we refer to as Shavu Brachos. Boaz Alman Hava, Rashi says, the Amar Mar Ivtsin Ze Boaz, because we know that there's a statement in the Gemara that Boaz was Ivtsin. Ivtsin is one of the Shoftim mentioned in Sefer Shoftim. Ukvar Hayu Lo Lamed Banim Ushloshim Banos. And he already had 30 sons and 30 daughters, Baba Basa. So we know that Ivtsin, who was Boaz, already had been married and had many children. So he was certainly a widower. Now Rashi explains, when we came to that final question, Ha'amr Shiva, you said that a bachar who marries an almana has 7 days of bracha. Rashi tells us, spells out the point that we have already discussed ourselves. That which Rav Huna said, she doesn't require Sheva Brachos. That's talking about she doesn't require for 7 days, but she does require for 1 day. Mechal, we can infer from that Te'una Dekalma Rabbi Abba Shiva. That which Rabbi Abba earlier, which was also Rav Huna, said that an Almana does require Sheva Brachos, it must be she does require Sheva Brachos for 7. Because it would be very odd for Rav Huna to say an Almana does require Sheva Brachos, and an Almana does not require Sheva Brachos, and to be talking about the same number of days, that is one, but one's by a bachar and one's by an alma. In other words, if the statement of Rav Huna was that an almana does not require shavu brachos for 7 days, she does require it for 1 day. In what instance? When she marries an alma. And an almana does require shavu brachos also for 1 day. But that's really the same halacha as an alma. In other words, essentially it would come out that although we wouldn't require the distinction of Bachar and Almon earlier in the Gemara, we didn't require the distinction of a widower and a young man who would marry a widow. It would come out that Rav Huna said two statements, meaning the same statement twice, meaning two different things. In other words, or I should say, he meant the same thing with two different statements. Rav Huna first said an Almana does require a bracha because she requires it for 1 day. And then later on he said an Almana does not require a bracha, meaning she does not require a bracha for all 7 days. Well, Rav Huna, which one is it? Why are you saying two different things and meaning the same thing? It's at the very least misleading, which is presumably why the Gemara did not use that approach earlier on in the Gemara. The Gemara had an original stira. The original contradiction was that Rav Huna says an almana does not require bracha, and yet he also said an almana does require bracha. Well, why didn't the Gemara say a much simpler answer? Rather than saying one's talking about a bachar and one's talking about an almun, why not say that one's talking about does not require a bracha for all 7 days, but does require a bracha for 1 day. And skip the whole distinction between bachar and alman. And presumably the reason is because that would be a very misleading statement. And thus with that Rashi, we can come to some level of clarity in the Cheshbon, the assembly line of the entire Gemara. It's certainly somewhat confusing, but in the end, when we work it out, it seems to make sense. Okay, let's proceed with the Gemara. The Gemara says, Meisavei. The Gemara has a question. Mevarchim the Basula Shiva la'almana yom echad. That for a Basula we make 7 days of Sheva Brachos, and for an Almana we only make 1 day of Sheva Brachos. And this seems to be a contradiction to what we've said previously. Why? So the Gemara spells out, my love, is it not afilu almana shenisis lebacher? Is it not that an almana only has 1 day of Sheva Brachos, even if she marries a bacher? And we were saying that an almana who marries a bacher requires Sheva Brachos for all 7 days. It's only when an almana marries a widower that she gets Sheva Brachos for only 1 day. So why is this Brisa saying that a besula gets Sheva Brachos, but an almana does not? So the Gemara answers, lo, la'almon, really she only gets Sheva Brachos for 1 day when she marries a widower, but when she marries a bacher, aval bacher, the Gemara spells out, when she marries a bacher, mai, shiva, she does in fact get 7 days of Sheva Brachos. So the Gemara says, the obvious question, the reason that they thought in the first place that it's talking about both a bacher and almon is because typically Mishnayos can be assumed to be applying the halacha in all cases unless we see specifically stated otherwise. Yihachi, if so, listening to Varcham the Basula Shiva, Gulalmana Shinishis the Bachar Shiva, Gulalmana Yom Echad. Let them have written that a Basula always gets 7 days of Sheva Brachos, and an Almana who marries a Bachar gets 7 days of Sheva Brachos, and an Almana who marries an Almon gets 1 day. So the answer is no subsikta katani. The Mishnah was written in a way of short speech. It was written in sort of a finite way. Why? What does it mean to say? The lack of basula de basu mishiva, you never have a basula who gets less than 7 days of Sheva Brachos. The lack of almana, you never have a widow who has less than 1 day of Sheva Brachos. It doesn't mean to say that an almana can't have more than 1 day of Sheva Brachos. An almana could, if she marries a bachar. But she'll never get less than one, even if she marries an almon, even if she marries a widow, where she still gets at least that 1 day of Sheva Brachos. Okay. Let us take a look at the next Gemara. It is a little bit what we call Agadata. It's a lot of just kind of darshaning of Sukkim from the story of Boaz and Rus, helping us to understand how we know what the halacha is supposed to be by various cases of Sheva Brachos. The Gemara says as follows, Gufa, which is to say, that statement itself, it's Gufa is a reference to a statement we've already quoted in the Gemara. We're now going to analyze that statement. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Lihuna Bar Nason, Tana, Minayim, the Birkas Chasanim Ba'asara. So this is one of the statements that we quoted of Rav Huna. How do we know that Birkas Chasanim requires 10 people? Shenemar, it says in the Pasuk, Vayikach Asara Anashim Mizikni Ha'ir. And he took 10 men from the elders of the city, Vayomar Shvupo, and he said to them, sit here. So therefore we see that it requires a minyan to have Sheva Brachos. Rabbi Abahu Amar Mehacha. And Rabbi Abahu says that we learn out that Sheva Brachos requires a minyan from a different pasuk. He quotes the pasuk, B'makhelos Baruchu Elokim, that in congregations are when we bless Hashem. Hashem Kar Yisrael. Hashem from the source of Israel. Rav Nachman, Bahai Krad Rav Yavo Mai Darash Bey. And Rav Nachman, what does he do with that pasuk of Rav Abo? So let's, before we address that, let's discuss a couple things that are necessary before we proceed. First, the Gemara doesn't exactly spell out how Makelus Baruch Hu Elokim Hashem Kar Yisrael is an indication that Sheva Brachos requires a minyan. Let's take a look at Rashi and see if Rashi clarifies that at all. Rashi says, "V'makhelos baruch hu Elokim Hashem im kar Yisrael." So he says, "Al birchas mekar, on the bracha of mekar of the source, tzarach kahal. You require a kahal, a congregation. V'hainu asara, and that is 10. K'mo hakel aseida, like we see hakel aseida, v'ein hakel b'pachos meida, And you can't have Hakal with less than an Eda, because we see a connection between Kahal and Eda. Eda is another word for congregation. Ve'eda Asara. And we know that the word Eda refers to 10 people. Kedi Alfinan me Adas Meraglim Admasai le'eda hara. Yasu Yeshua v'kalev. We know the Meraglim were referred to as an Eda, and although there were 12 Meraglim, we know that it was referring to Eda Hara, the bad Eda, the bad congregation. And of the 12 Meraglim, only 10 of them actually were bad, and therefore we see the word Eda refers to 10. If Eda refers to 10, that means Hakel has to be done with 10 as well, because it says Hakel as Eda, and therefore Kahal refers to 10 as well. And if so, Makelos Baruch Elokim Hashemim Kar Yisrael tells us that Makelos, with a group of 10 people, we Baruch Elokim, in a case where it's the Bracha of Makar. And the Bracha of Makar is a reference to Sheva Brachos. Rashi does not tell us exactly how that is true. I believe the Pshat is because Makar is a reference to the womb, and this is the time when a couple are getting together in order to have children. In any event, before we proceed, just one other point that we need to spell out is that Rav Nachman is now being asked in the Gemara, what is he going to do with the pasuk of Rav Avo? Right, let's read that one more time. Rav Nachman, b'hai kro de Rabbi Avo, my darish bay. What does Rav Nachman darshan the pasuk of Rav Avo for? In other words, we assume that in any instance where two different Amorayim are discussing the ways that they use a particular pasuk in order, in other words, how do they understand a particular pasuk to be telling us a halacha, or what halacha do they assume a particular pasuk is telling us? If one Amora uses a pasuk for drasha A, and the other Amora does not use it for that drasha, we assume that that Amora B has a different use for pasuk A. And similarly, vice versa. And the Gemara feels that they can ask that question on the other Amora, and the goal of that question is, well, if you don't have a different use for that pasuk, why didn't you use that pasuk and free up the pasuk that you did use? In other words, in this instance, Rav Nachman did not use the pasuk of B'makelos Baruch Elokim. Well, if he could have learned the halacha of Sheva Brachos requiring 10 from the pasuk of B'makelos Baruch Elokim, so then why didn't he do that and free up the pasuk of Vayikach Hasara Anashim Yizik Nehair to teach us something else? So the Gemara asks Rav Nachman b'hai krad Rabbi Avo my darish bay. So what in fact does Rav Nachman do use the pasuk of Makelos Baruch Elokim? Mibayle, he requires it l'chadetanya for that which it said in the Braisa. Hayir Rav Meir Omer, Rav Meir used to say, minayim sha'afilu ubarim ubarim shvimei iman amru shir aliyam. How do we know that even fetuses that were still in their mother's wombs said shira, sang the song on the sea, referring to when Bnei Yisrael crossed the Yamsuf, when Hashem split the Yamsuf, they came on the other side and they sang Az Yashir. So Rav Meir is learning out, how do we know that even the fetuses, who were at that time still in utero, also sang Shira, also sang when they reached the other side of the Yamsuf? Shenamar b'makelos baruch elokim Hashem im kar Yisrael. That this pasuk of Makelos, and therefore in the same way Rav Nachman uses that pasuk to teach me this. It's not a halacha, but it is a piece of Torah that we would not have known if not for this pasuk. So the Gemara now challenges, and this is an interesting style that the Gemara does. The Gemara will now challenge Rav Avo to say, well, Rav Avo, why did you not understand the pasuk of Makelos that way? In other words, now that we've started following this thread of what does Rav Nachman do with the pasuk of Rav Avo Makelos, now we want to know, well, since Rav Nachman has a legitimate use for it, why did Rav Avo not use Rav Nachman's use of Makelos? The Gemara asks to Yidach, and the other one, meaning Rav Avo, what do you do with the pasuk? Why do you not use the pasuk of the Makelos the way that Rav Nachman used it? The Gemara says, Im Kain, if so, Le Makra Mi Betem. Let the pasuk have said, Mi Betem from the belly, Maim in Makar. What does it mean from the word Makar? Al Iske Makar. And the dealings of Makar, which presumably means on the dealings of sort of that are of the source, meaning not actually a womb per se, but the fact that the chasan and kala are themselves the source of the household and the beginning of the household, and therefore that's how the word makor refers to the chasan and kala. And now the Gemara turns things around. Rabbi Avo, my high quadra of Nachman, my darish bay. What does Rabbi Avo do with the pasuk of Rabbi Nachman of Vayika Chasara Anoshim? Because if he could learn out his halacha of Sheva Brachos requiring 10 from Rabbi Nachman's pasuk, then he could use the pasuk of B'makelos for something else. And perhaps he would even use it for Rabbi Nachman's halacha, because if he didn't have his own halacha or his own drasha to use in the pasuk of B'makelos, maybe, although it's not the perfect wording, he would still learn out of Meir's drasha of fetuses singing Shir on the Yam. So therefore he has to have a defense. What does he do with Rav Nachman's pasuk of Vayiga Chasara Anashim? So the Gemara answers, Ha'umi Ba'ile, that pasuk is necessary, Lemedrish, Tadarshan, Amoni V'la Amonis, Moavi V'la Moavis. There's a halacha that we know, that we learn out from Rus, that although the Torah says that an Amoni and a Moavi, a person from the nation of Ammon and Moab, cannot enter Klal Yisrael, cannot marry into Klal Yisrael until the third generation after Geirus, after conversion, it does not apply to, it does not apply to a female person from Ammon or a female from Moab. Such a person could, if they convert, could marry into Klal Yisrael right away, which is a very relevant drasha to Boaz, because Rus was a first generation convert. And if she had not been able to marry in because of the fact that she was a female, and the Torah said that a first generation Ammon and Moab cannot marry into Klal Yisrael right away, Boaz would have been being over Allah by marrying Rus. So it's very relevant to the Megillah of Rus, this drasha of Ammoni v'la Ammonis, Moabi v'la Moabis. And the Gemara says, the istaka da'itach lebracha lo sagya. Lo sagya d'lav zekenim. And he wants to say that if you want to tell me that it's about Baruchah, this is about Shavuot Baruchah, why does it have to be Zekanim? Why did Boaz have to get elders? Why couldn't he just get anybody? In other words, he wants to understand, why would the Pasuk be telling me that Boaz went to get 10 Zekanim in order for Shavuot Baruchah, in order to have 10 men for Shavuot Baruchah? He wouldn't require Zekanim for that. He could simply get any man. Any man counts for a minion if he's over Bar Mitzvah. The fact that he went to get the Canaan, it's indicative that he needed something more than just a service that any person, any gadol, any fully grown Jewish man could provide. He needed somebody to learn it in order to have this drasha, to be able to paskin that it really, when the Torah says Amoni, it means Amoni v'lo Amonis. That it's not a female person who's not allowed in the first generation after conversion. And for that you need a bezdin, that you need 10 ordained men, 10 Zekanim, who could qualify to paskin this shaila. Ve'ida, and the other person. So if that's the case, how does he respond to the fact that it says 10 men, it says Zekanim. So Isak Adaitach Lemedrash Lo Sagya. If you think that the problem is that did you not need 10 in order, or 10 regular people in order to do Shavuot Brachos, in the answer is yes. You wouldn't need just 10 men, 10 non-Zekanim to do Shavuot Brachos. The Pesumi Milsa, in order to publicize the matter. What exactly are we publicizing here? The Gemara is not so clear. It seems like Boaz wanted his marriage to Rus to be public. Because of the fact that, in other words, it seems as if Rav Nachman, who darshan the pasuk of Vayigach Chasara Anashim Mizikni Ha'ir, to be telling me that we require 10 men for Shavuot Brachos, it was responding to Ravo by saying, if it meant for Drusha, if the whole point of having 10 Zekanim was in order to have 10 qualified leaders who could then paskin the Shaila of Amoni v'la Amonis, Moavi v'la Moavis, if that was the verb, Isak adaitach lemidrash, lo sagi d'la vasar, would it not be enough that you didn't have 10 people? You don't need 10 people for such a Shaila, you need a Bezdin, perhaps. Maybe Boaz on his own was not enough, he needed others, and they needed to be Zekanim, but he didn't need 10. So what would be the point of having gathered 10? And now Rav Avohu responds in the Fesume Milsa. In other words, it wasn't a point of publicizing the marriage of Boaz and Ruth per se. The point was to publicize this halacha of Amoni v'lo Amonis, Moavi v'lo Moavis, and therefore that was why, even if the purpose was to darshan and to paskin halacha, and that's why you needed zakenim, 10 were needed in order that those 10 could then publicize the matter that Amoni v'lo Amonis, Moavi v'lo Moavis. And the Gemara brings a riot to the idea that you would want 10 to paskin in order to make it public. And like Shmuel said to Rav Chana, who is from Baghdad, Puk va'aisi li be'asara, go and get for me 10 people, ve'im l'cha ba'an payu, and I will say in front of them, hamzaka lo berkana, that one who is mizaka something for an uber is kona. What exactly that means, we'll see in Rashi, v'hilchasa, and the Gemara paskins, hamzaka lo ber lo kona, that one who does in fact zocha something for an uber, that kinyan that person made, that acquisition for the uber, for the fetus, does not work. So what exactly is that last piece of Gemara referring to? Let's just see. Rashi says Bagdatha Irsh of Bavel. Rashi says it's a city that was in Bavel, Ushma Baghdad, and its name was Baghdad. The city that we know today is Baghdad as well. And Rashi tells us that it's mentioned in the listing of cities of Rav Shira Gaon. Rashi says, "I'm a zaka, matan al yidacher, one who is a zocha, one who makes an acquisition for a." An ober for a fetus through somebody else, lo ober to a fetus, imo, who is in the womb of its mother, kana, that ober is kana. In other words, let us say that I want to give something to a person, but that person is not yet born. So I can give the gift with the idea that I'm giving it specifically to that unborn child and have somebody else do an active kinyan upon it. In other words, let us say I have my phone and I want this phone to go to the non-born child of my sister because the phone has a lot of family sentimental value and I want him to be the owner of it. And I'm concerned that there shouldn't be a dispute about who owns the phone if someday I'm not around to make sure that the phone goes into the right hands. So therefore, I'm going to create a transaction wherein I get this phone to the upper, to the fetus. However, the problem is that the way a kinyan is done, the way acquisition is done, is by doing some kind of an action of acquisition to the phone. For example, a kinyan of hagbah would be taking the phone and picking it up at least 3 tefachim. Such an action is an indication of ownership, and even though the person who would be acquiring it, let's say even a katan, a child under 13 does not have the ability to acquire things of his own accord, a katan could acquire things if he makes a kinyan on it and there's somebody else who owned it previously sort of pushing it in his direction, so to speak, what we call das makna. In other words, I am the giver of this phone and I'm giving it to the katan, and then he makes a kinyan on it to acquire it from me. Such a transaction can work. However, an ober, a fetus, can obviously not do such a thing because the fetus is still unborn. Therefore, what we do is the following trick. We say that when a person acquires something with the idea that they want to acquire it for somebody else, let us say a metzia, a lost object that's found, if I go up to this lost object and pick it up specifically with intent to pick it up to acquire it for my friend, that acquisition works, and he is now the owner of that object, even though he's not here. Because we can assume that my friend would want to acquire such a lost object. It's free. What does he have to lose by gaining it? And therefore, we can presume that he would want me to be his agent, his shliach, if he were here to appoint me. And therefore, because I can act as an agent even without him appointing me, in an instance where it's something that's completely for his benefit. And in the same way, we can do that for a katan when the katan is not necessarily here, if you have that extra ingredient of what's called das makna, the person who's the previous owner, causing the ownership of the object to be given to this katan. And similarly, we can use that trick when we're dealing with a fetus. The action of kinyan, of acquiring, is going to be done by the whoever the person is that I ask, an adult even, to pick up the object. I give it to him with the idea that he's acquiring it for the fetus. He picks it up with the idea that he's acquiring it for the fetus. And then, it is now property of the fetus, so much as a fetus can have property. So there seems to be some debate whether such a transaction works. Shmuel wanted 10 people in front of whom he could say that it does work, so that those 10 people could then go and spread that word. As it happens, the halacha is that such a transaction does not work, and the Gemara Paskin is such. And therefore, although Shmuel wanted to publicize this halacha, it was a halacha that we do not Paskin like. We disagree with Shmuel in this instance. And again, we do not, ourselves, do not have the ability to disagree with Shmuel, the great Amora, but the Gemara did have the ability to address Pesach in such a way. Okay, we're up to two dots. However, let us see a little bit more in the Gemara. We're going to get up to just before the text of the actual Shavuot Brachos, which is something that we're going to see next time. But before that, we're going to see the Brachos of Erison. Tana Rabbanan, our rabbis taught. Mevarchan birchas chasanim v'beveis chasanim. We make Shavuot Brachos in the house of chasanim. We even do it in the house of betrothal. What exactly does that mean? Let us see Rashi. The Veis Chasanim, Rashi says, when they are entered into under the chuppah, that's when we can make the Shavuot Brachos. And Rabbi Yehuda added, Rashi says, when he's Mekadesher, when Kedushin is done before the Nesu'in, which in the time of the Gemara was a year prior, kol birchas chasanim, that was when they would make all the brachos of Shavuot Brachos, Kedem Mefarish. It's almost as if, it's kind of interesting, when the betrothal was done, sort of what we kind of view as the engagement, which was a year before the marriage was to be finalized, the marriage was initially made with Shavuot Brachos, but that was the engagement. Of course, it was more than the engagement because it was something that would require a get, a divorce contract. Certainly, it was structured differently than the way marriages are done today. But it's interesting to think that on the day that they did the engagement, at what would have been the engagement party, they did Shavuot Brachos. Amar Abaye, and the Gemara says further, Abaye said, "Uv Yehuda Shanu." And in Yehuda, they taught, we made those brachos because there was a minhag for the chasan and kal to be miyached together. In other words, even though they weren't fully married yet, there was a minhag for them to be allowed to be in a room together by themselves. And that was something that was we find elsewhere in the Gemara as well, that in the land of the part of Eretz Yisrael that was referred to as the land of Yehuda, they would have this custom to have the chasan and kala be miyache together when they were engaged, when they had kedushin done. Tanya idach, we learned in another brisa, mevarchan birchas chasanim beveis chasanim, ubirchas erison beveis erison. That shavuot brachos birchas chasanim was done in the beis chasanim by the chuppah, by the nesuin, but birchas erison was done in the beis erison. So the Gemara asks, birchas erison my mevarch. But what was the bracha of Erison? What was that bracha that they made at the time of betrothal, at the time of Kedushin? Rabin bar Rav Ada, Barabba bar Rav Ada, Tarayu Mishmeidu Rav Yehuda Amri, they said, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Asher Kedushanu B'Mitzvosav V'Tzivanu Al HaArayos, that he commanded us on the Arayos to stay away from the forbidden relations, V'Asher Lanu Es HaRusos, and forbid to us those who are betrothed, and permitted to us those who are fully married. It's a little bit funny, in other words, the ones who are arusos, who are usher to us, are the ones who were betrothed to somebody else, and yet the ones who are nesuos, who are mutter to us, are the ones who are nesuos sort of to us. In other words, a person is only mutter to his own wife. Through chuba v'kiddushin. And the Gemara adds, Rav Acha b'rei de Rava, Misayim ba, Mishmei de Rav Yehuda, that there was an additional concluding bracha added, Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech, not Elokeinu Melech Olam, it's just Baruch Atah Hashem, Mekadesh Yisrael, Ayde Chuba V'Kiddushin. So the complete bracha was, Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Olam, Asher Gashem, Mitzvah V'Tzivan Al Arayis, V'Asher Lan Asar, Rizvah V'Tzivan Al Asar, Nesuah, Ayde Chuba V'Kiddushin, Baruch Atah Hashem, Mekadesh Yisrael, Ayde Chuba V'Kiddushin. And the Gemara explained that there seems to be a machlokas whether or not there was a concluding bracha added. Mandalochasim midi dehava birchas peros by birchas mitzvos. Why is it any different than a bracha that one makes on food or on a mitzvah which doesn't have a conclusion? We know bari per ha'etz or birchas mitzvos would be making a bracha on tzitzis. Bracha Hashem lekinam alcholam shek Hashem uzev sivanu pisatet ba tzitzis. That's a bracha that we make which has no concluding bracha. It's just the bracha itself. The person who did have a conclusion, he did have a kiddush. Why is he different than kiddush? When a person makes kiddush on Friday night, he also has a concluding bracha, and this Tana felt was similar, more similar to that. We'll hold it here for now because the next piece is a new thing. Have a good week, everyone.